The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today the issue is the Middle East, and Kamran Bakari has been a guest that we've had on a number of times during this evolving situation, because what once were nations are now turning into just rogue states, actually, and these rogue states are falling prey to non-state actors, and so it's hard to keep up with, you know, Syria, Israel. Well, Israel's probably one of the only nations still left, but Egypt, you know, you name it.
If you were to think of there being sort of one anchor or a rock immovable in the Middle East, it would be Israel. With the amount of changes that have occurred post-Arab Spring, and as you mentioned, the transition from state actors and the secular nationalists, the autocratic regimes, to now non-state actors and fledgling democracies, if they are that, then yes, I mean, there's a lot of clarification that needs to take place, because you still have a vying for power in the region. Will it be Turkey? Will it be Iran? Will it be Egypt? How will that play out? It's very significant in terms of both world events, Middle Eastern peace, and also things like the price of oil and the world economy. So we are continuing our conversation with Kamran Bakari, an analyst with Stratford Global Intelligence, and we're looking today at the changes in the Middle East, which are of a critical nature to the stability, not only the region, but also a contributing factor to a world which is either in economic recovery or not, moving towards greater political stability or not. Now, too often Americans limit their range of interest to the draft, say, not the military draft, but, you know, first-round draft picks in the NFL and what have you. Domestic policy issues barely reach the radar screen, and it's very, very important to move beyond sort of provincial interests to issues which have great importance. Here we are with the Middle East, which has been long considered the cradle of civilization, and it has and will continue to play a dominant role in world politics and geoeconomic stability. Quote Robert Kaplan, who's a fellow analyst with you at Stratford Global Intelligence, he says, "The combination of blood, belief, and technology have given us a neo-medieval map that, rather than one of flourishing civilizations, is, in the case of Syria and Iraq, one of clans, gangs, and chaos." And that's perhaps where we could start. You know, the new map of the Middle East is in some respects like the old map of the Middle East in medieval times, where, frankly, what we have today in terms of normal frontiers and borders, they were undefined then, and to some degree they're undefined now. Influence and control was really amongst strong men, with the proximity of their strength sort of being right next to them. You know, so we have Turkey. We have, overlapping issues between Turkey and Syria with Kurdish separatists and whatnot. You have, of course, the Lebanese issues in the south of Syria fueled by Hezbollah. You've got factions in Islam, which are obviously plentiful, but it's difficult, I think, for us to understand the granularity involved, the importance of some of the distinctions. And maybe you could begin this conversation with us today, Kamran, with looking at the Arab Spring, what began happening with the Arab Spring, and sort of what that has set in motion. Then we can talk about Syria and some of the other factors, even stretching onto Afghanistan.
Yes, I would actually, before I jump into the Arab Spring, just like Kaplan has written, the idea of fixed borders is actually something that's, you know, an exception rather than the rule to the general history of mankind. If we look at, you know, the last 100 years or so, or however we want to define the modern age, what has existed in the form, or at least the effort to have nation states with fixed territories recognized internationally, this is a new phenomenon, considering the bulk of human history. And so I don't think that necessarily it has something to do with the Middle East. Because the Middle East, the question of the Middle East did not really get settled with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the rise of European colonial powers and the decolonization of the area. So we were still sort of evolving from that major development where we had the collapse of large empires and the inability of nation states to really take hold, with, of course, some large exceptions, Turkey being one of them, Iran being another one, and then there is Egypt. So having said that, with the Arab Spring has basically undone is in the process of undoing the order that was established in the post-colonial age, where you had secular nationalist autocratic regimes emerge. Now, those regimes are either, you know, in meltdown or have completely collapsed, as is the case with Libya, and we're witnessing something very similar in the case of Syria. With the exception of Syria, we have moved beyond sort of the uprising phase or the revolutionary phase, as many would put it. We are now in a transitional period where there is an effort. So the old regimes are gone or, you know, on their last legs. And the question is, are we going to move to something that is going to replace the old order? So the Ancien regime is gone. We don't have a new one, and that's where the struggle lies within the region.
You know, and this goes back to that notion that there is perhaps a solidarity group, a family tie, some sort of dynasty that needs to be created in the place of what has been just displaced. Is that really what we're beginning to see is sort of who will send down roots, who will represent not the autocratic regime of the past, but some sort of regime here in the immediate future?
I would look at this in the form of stakeholders. I think that's a good enough neutral term to encompass, or general term to encompass the various actors that are actually in play. So yes, there are tribes, there are notable families, there are clans, there are what we would call, you know, organized criminal entities, and of course, political parties, ideological groups, economic interests. So we'll just use the word stakeholder. And I think all of those stakeholders are now looking at threats and opportunities. Threats in the sense that for those who have benefited from the old order and are now in a state of uncertainty as to, you know, where their fortunes are headed. So there is the element of threats. There are opportunities for those who are out of power, and there are lots of groups that were out of power, and now there is an opportunity for them to seek power. But their internal incoherence, the word here that sort of really tells the story is fragmentation. So, for example, if you look at the Islamists in Egypt, they are an extremely fragmented group. I mean, the word Islam, to the point that the word Islamist has become meaningless, if you will, because who are we really talking about? Are we talking about the Brotherhood? Are we talking about the Salafists? Then within the Brotherhood, who are we really talking about? Because there's so much internal factionalization. There are at least 7 or 8 different Salafist parties that have come out and registered themselves as political forces in Egypt. And then there's the wider Salafist camp that's still out there in the apolitical realm. And so fragmentation and multiplicity of actors with overlapping interests and in a struggle with each other and with remnants of the old order. And I mean, there are still quite strong centers of power. So, for example, in Egypt, the military is pretty strong. The judiciary is there. The bureaucracy is there. And we can make a similar case for Algeria. There are also civil society forces. I meant to say Tunisia, not Algeria. There are also civil society forces that don't have to do with the state, particularly in a place like Tunisia, where there is a resistance to the rise of Islamist forces. And it's a fairly robust resistance, although it doesn't get the coverage that in the media that it probably deserves. But there is, you know, a push and pull in multiple directions.
You know, when we look at the developments in Syria, we continue to see arms come from Russia and support from across the Iraqi desert coming from Iran. You have Hezbollah fighters coming up north from Lebanon, encouraged and funded by Iran. This would appear that the Assad regime has perhaps enough support to not flicker or flame out at any time in the near future. Very hesitant participation by the West, some support for the rebels coming from European states, some behind-the-scenes support coming from the U.S., and perhaps the most outright support coming from the Saudi government, you know, looking for some sort of a Sunni counterweight in the region. What, as you look at Syria, have we lost time? 2 years? Is it too late to be involved? Is there any point to being involved? We know what the red line is according to Obama, but, you know, in the absence of chemical warfare, do we escalate and see again the toppling of the Assad regime? Or with the support that he has from Iran and Russia, is he here to stay at least for some time?
I think the idea that we lost time assumes that there was time in the beginning. I mean, in other words, an intervention of sorts was perhaps possible in the beginning. But if you go back and look at each stage, if there are stages that can be discerned over the last 2 years, you would find that the same argument would be made, and quite powerfully, that the risks of intervention are far greater than the benefits. And so I don't think that we can look at it in that sort of respect. And of course, the United States' red line is also shifting, if you will. I mean, if you look at the red line of the use of chemical weapons, or just the chemical weapons, the involvement of chemical weapons in the Syrian theater, there are two aspects to it. One is if the regime were to use those chemical weapons. And we've seen in the last 24 to 48 hours where the United States government from the highest levels has actually acknowledged that in limited forms, these weapons have been used. There is evidence to suggest, obviously, the statements, if you go through them and sort of in the exact statements, you'll see that they're heavily caveated. Nonetheless, there is now a sort of a progression where it's not just, you know, well, once you use chemical weapons, we will come in. There's a qualifier to it in terms of to what level and scale are these weapons being used. So that's the first red line. There's another red line, which is that if these weapons were under the risk of falling into the wrong hands, i.e. Islamist militant non-state actors, jihadists, and other unsavory characters such as, you know, Hezbollah, so that would constitute or warrant an intervention. So the red line itself has shifted over a period of time. Now, as to your question about the endurance of the regime, well, the regime needs to be defined as well. One of the things to keep in mind is that it would be really fair to say that President Assad and his regime, for lack of a better term, has actually devolved and because it's lost control over large swaths of the country. And it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that he is perhaps devolving to the level of a non-state actor, still the most powerful non-state actor in the country because of the strength, the intrinsic strength of the regime over the decades. This is not a Libya, definitely not a Tunisia, and very different from Egypt, where we saw the strongmen toppled. And then there is a large amount of support, as you mentioned, from Iran, from Hezbollah, from Russia. And there is a general aversion on the part of the United States and its allies to go for the jugular of the regime. And so, yes, the regime is going to endure, but it's also changing form. So its writ is shrinking, albeit very slowly, but nonetheless very noticeably, because if large parts of the countryside out in the east and the north and the south are in the hands of disparate rebel groups, then that's not the same regime that we were looking at, say, a year ago. Then there is the question of the personality of President Assad, his family, his clan, the Alawite sect, which dominates the existing order, and of course the Ba'ath Party and its military apparatuses. So, you know, if we could see that President Assad, it is very feasible that, you know, like what happened last year in July with the bombing at the National Security Agency, where three top level officials of the government were assassinated, that, you know, at some point President Assad could, you know, fall victim to an assassin's bullet or a suicide bombing. This is not beyond the realm of possibility. So what happens then? Does that mean that the regime collapses? It could, but it is in the interest of those surrounding President Assad, the various elements of his regime and the outside supporters, to make sure that, because they are aware that of such a risk. So they are likely prepared to continue to try and endure. So we really need to be careful with, you know, terminology of regime collapse and, you know, regime change and so on and so forth.
you know, some of the complexity in the region does go back to Afghanistan, and I know you would like to talk a little bit about Afghanistan today, but before we get there, maybe the Afghanistan of yesterday, the U.S. put money behind the most likely to succeed in the conflict between the Afghan freedom fighters and the USSR going back decades now. They happen to be the most radical in their Islamic beliefs and thus most willing to fight to the death. Now we have the same issue with the Saudis funding the most radical resistance movements in Syria on a most likely to succeed basis. But the question remains, what challenges does this present diplomatically moving out 5, 10, 15 years? I mean, in the meantime, for the Saudis, it appears that the disaffected youth in Saudi Arabia have a place to go and to fight. And this is, of course, conjecture, but perhaps the Saudi government sees this as a place for them to die, you know, disassociated from the Saudi kingdom and the rumblings of a discontentment amongst, again, this group of disaffected youth. But the conflict lasts longer when you empower and essentially give real-world training to the most committed Islamists. We've seen that in Afghanistan with the later birth of al-Qaeda. What are we giving birth to here in the midst of allowing the rebels who are fighting the Assad regime to grow? Explain some of this complexity for us.
In an effort to roll back Iranian influence in the region, the Saudis have actually devoted a disproportionate amount of their resources to the fight in Syria. Because if you look at the map of the region strategically, you will see that regime change in Iraq allowed Iran at least to have the opportunity to create a contiguous sphere of influence stretching from western Afghanistan all the way to the eastern Mediterranean, Lebanon. And that was the case just before the Arab Spring hit Syria in March of 2011. Until then, from the Iranian point of view, from their strategic window, it was blue skies because they had achieved what they had wanted and things were looking bright and good. From the Saudi point of view, this was really a nightmare scenario because their regional rival, their historical, you know, sectarian rival, had gained a disproportionate amount of influence. Not only was the buffer of Iraq gone, but now there was potentially a large Iranian sphere of influence just really overbearing for the Saudis. The Syrian conflict, the uprising, created an opportunity for the Saudis to say, here's where we can punch a hole in this sphere of influence, and a significant one, one that would not only undermine Iranian influence in Syria, but if the Syrian regime were to collapse, Iranian influence in Lebanon and Iraq, in Lebanon would weaken, Hezbollah would be disconnected in many ways from the Iranians, and the Iranian position, the nascent Iranian position in Iraq, would also come under an extreme amount of pressure. So as long as the Iranians are on the defensive, they can't go on the offensive. In this quest, the Saudis have, you know, essentially adopted a policy where the drumbeat of jihad in Syria is essentially based on the idea that you will find the most zealous of all religious elements will be the ones who would be the most effective fighters as we've seen in Iraq, as we've seen in Afghanistan. Those fighters, some of whom, you know, may have at some point opposed the Saudis, have been redirected to the fight in Syria because the motivation is that these are Shia, and then, you know, the regime itself is not even Shia, it's Alawite, which is considered, from the Saudi point of view, worse than the Shia. And so there's a sectarian religious motivation to fight this regime that has suppressed the Sunni majority of the country, and therefore it is creating a landscape of battle-hardened fighters who will pose a problem later on. In other words, the Saudis, through the deployment of jihad in Syria, are creating a new manifestation of jihadism. In other words, you will have a new form of al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda has become this general purpose moniker to explain all forms of Islamist militants. But from our point of view, al-Qaeda in Syria would represent an element, a force that would not necessarily in the future even be willing to, if you will, align with Saudi interests. So there's, as we've learned in Iraq, we've learned in Afghanistan, that once you set proxies into motion, it doesn't take long for them to go independent, especially if they have their own ideology, their own agenda, and for them to take on a life of their own, as we saw in Afghanistan. So I think that's what we're looking at in Syria. And the danger in Syria is that it borders some key countries, Israel, it borders Lebanon and Iraq, Turkey and Jordan. So the risk of spillover, the risk of a regional conflict is very high. And the Saudis, in their sort of effort to just undermine the Iranian influence, it seems that they are overlooking the costs of this investment. One of the motivating factors for them, or at least which gives them comfort, is they don't have a border with Syria, so that they feel that they're insulated from whatever spillover or unintended consequences will emerge from this investment.
And that seems to be a primary consideration for us. If they're overlooking the cost, essentially they're trying to check the power, as you say, of the Iranian regime, but are adding to what is already developing as a real issue in the Middle East, that many more non-state actors. And that is, as you say, maybe it's far enough away, but for everyone else in the Middle East, we have, you know, the U.S., which has just sent the first armored division, or around 200 troops deployed to Jordan under the guise of assisting the Jordanians in handling Syrian refugees. You also have the U.S. just signing an arms deal with Israel, with Saudi Arabia, with the United Arab Emirates. And very interestingly, it appears, at least from what is a part of that arms deal, to be focused on Iran and not on the emergence of, again, these sort of non-state actors like Al-Qaeda. So with Israel, you've got the KC-135 Stratotankers, the mid-air refueling. That's being put on the table. You've got the AGM-88 anti-radar missiles and the Osprey aircraft. I mean, again, all of these things are, if you look at the anti-radar missiles, the Stratotankers for mid-air refueling, Tehran's 1,500 or plus miles away. It seems that we're throwing our weight in, again, not necessarily into the Syrian conflict, but we are creating or trying to create something of a deterrence in the region. Saudi Arabia, I think it was actually the United Arab Emirates that received is going to receive the Desert Falcons, the 26 of the F-16s. But is this what we're seeing, is sort of the way we play our hands, the U.S., in terms of foreign policy, the way we play our hands is by some sort of, you know, buying deterrence, if you will?
Yes, absolutely. And I think at the heart of all of the strategic outlook is the question of how to balance between two sets of threats. One threat being Sunni radicalism, whether in the form of non-state actors or the rise of an Islamist regime that could be as moderate as the Brotherhood or in Egypt or Ennahda in Tunisia. But nonetheless, having a divergence of interest, a significant divergence of interest with the United States. So that's one level of threat. On the other hand, you have an Iranian-led radicalism, which is another form of a threat, where Iran has its own competing vision of what the region should look like and supports groups like Hezbollah and ultimately would like to consolidate its gains in Iraq and preserve them from any fallout from Syria. So the United States and its allies are caught between these two trends, and therefore it has to balance. I mean, and if you look at how the history of the last 10 to 12 years, you will see sort of almost a sort of a pendulum effect. Right after 9/11, the United States aligned itself with Iran to fight the rise of what was a common enemy, Al-Qaeda and jihadism, and then the Taliban. And of course, with the invasion of Iraq, that was something that was very much in the interest of the Iranian government. At some point after regime collapse in Iraq, and when it became apparent that the Shiite and Kurdish partners of the United States who worked with them to topple Saddam were actually much more closer to Iran than to the United States. And that's when the United States decided that it was perhaps time to swing back to the Sunni world and reach out to the Sunni insurgents. And that's where we saw the rise of the Awakening Council in Iraq, the tribal militias that fought Al-Qaeda, and then were encouraged to join the political system so as to create a balance. Now, with the rise of the Arab Spring, and the situation in Mali and in Libya, and the natural gas facility that was attacked in Algeria, the attack on the U.S. diplomatic post in Libya during the anti-Mohammed movie, the controversy last year, and more recently with Syria going the way of jihadism, at least in the form of non-state actors. All of this is sort of forcing the United States to sort of revise its strategy and say perhaps it's time to swing a bit back towards Iran, because ultimately there's no permanent fix. You can't completely deal with Iran because of the obvious complications of the nuclear issue, the three some decades of non-diplomatic relations with the United States. And so there's a lot of ground to cover there. But at least if there is some sort of a tactical understanding, then there perhaps is a way to balance between these two types of threats. And hence we see the statement from Secretary of State John Kerry, who, in March, actually said that, the government of Syria and the rebels need to reach negotiated settlement. We're seeing some faint signs of progress, or at least what appears to be progress in the nuclear talks. So it seems like there is this constant balancing act that the United States and its allies have to pursue in order to be able to deal with the region of the Middle East.
It is a balancing act, and it's a balancing act in a context that seems fairly unstable. As we conclude, and as you're looking at sort of the region as a whole, I know that when we took the Iraqi balance of power between Iraq, Egypt, and Iran and upset that balance of power, that was our own doing, our foreign policy, perhaps a misstep, perhaps, clearly we had our reasons, many of them may be unfounded, some of them may have been well-founded, but the Middle East now is what it is. So when we're thinking of Turkey, we're again thinking of another state actor in this balancing act between Iraq, Iran, Egypt, and of course Turkey playing a major role. How does this, do we begin to see an ultimate codification, solidification of leadership in the Middle East? Are the elections coming up in June in Iran a significant event? Or can we expect to see Turkey continue to move towards sort of the reestablishment of the Ottoman Empire, as Erdogan has at least suggested?
I think that the United States, for some time now, has sought to rely on Turkey to help it manage the Middle East. And Turkey is much better placed than the United States because it's indigenous to the region. There are historical, religious, and cultural linkages. There are political linkages. The problem with Turkey's ability to manage the Middle East is that immediately on its three borders, it finds itself, for lack of a better term, blocked by Iran. So if you look at the Turkish-Iraqi border, well, let's begin with the Turkish. You have the Turkish-Iranian border, so Iran and Turkey share a border. So it is a major power, a competitor to Turkey. But Iran is, even though it's not as powerful as Turkey, but nonetheless, Iran enjoys a disproportionate amount of influence in the border regions of Turkey. Now, if you look at Iraq, Iraq is almost completely under Iranian influence, with some notable exceptions. But nonetheless, it's fair to say that Iran has far more influence in Iraq than Turkey. Turkey is trying to develop influence, especially with the link with the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government, which also helps Turkey deal with another major domestic problem, which is Kurdish separatism. So in an effort to deal with Iranian influence and its own domestic Kurdish insurgency, the Turks are trying to develop relations with Iraq. But still, it's going to take a while before that will happen, and we are not sure if this is a linear process at all. There's another border that Turkey has, and that's with Syria. And that brings us back to the Syrian crisis, because from Turkey's point of view, it doesn't share the Saudi zeal to undermine Iranian influence. But nonetheless, if this regime in Syria were to be replaced with a more favorable regime that is close to Turkey, then Turkey would have made some significant inroads into what has long been, the Iranian sphere of influence. And once in Syria, it could go back to, the old Ottoman times, where it was able to project power in the wider Middle East, stretching to the Palestinian territories, Jordan, and of course, North Africa. There, Turkey runs into Egypt, and Egypt, though one of the weakest players right now in the entire region, in fact, the weakest amongst the major states in the Middle East, nonetheless, Egypt is not ready to just accept Turkish hegemony, and we've seen evidence of pushback. For example, last year in August, when Prime Minister Erdogan visited Egypt, and he basically in a speech said that the Muslim Brotherhood leadership should not be afraid of secularism and should embrace it because it doesn't really contradict our religious values. The Muslim Brotherhood essentially shot back and said, we appreciate your achievements and we respect them, but we don't need a lecture on secularism. We have our own views. And if you look at it beyond the ideological level and look at it historically, Egypt has always been resistant to Turkish hegemony in the region. So for Turkey to be able to deal with the region, A, it has to deal with Iran, somehow has to go around it. Turkey's not interested in a conflict with Iran. Syria has to materialize. The Syrian conflict has to lead to some sort of a favorable outcome for the Turks. And then the Turks also have to deal with countries like Egypt. And then there is obviously Saudi Arabia and its politics in the region that could diverge from Turkish interests. So that is the problem with Turkey. It is a potential power, but there are a lot of arresters in its path.
Well, and lastly, Israel is not a country that we're mentioning here as one who's vying for power and influence in the region, yet they're a significant player in the region. How would you define their significance today? And are they feeling stress and strain over, sort of the tactical understandings, as you've described, as they're developing? What's their position in response to Iran and Syria?
If you look at it from the Israeli point of view, the region is, tossing and turning in really unpredictable and very dangerous ways. One of the biggest problem or, concern for Israel is what will be the relationship with Egypt, say 5 years from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. Clearly, Egypt is not in a position to abrogate the Camp David Accords, the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. That would be an extreme case, which is unlikely given the weakness of Egypt and the dependence of Egypt on outside financial assistance. So that's not something that we can expect to happen. But short of that, there are lots of things that can go wrong, which is that, Egypt has already begun to behave very differently. Egypt, under the Muslim Brotherhood government, is already beginning to assert itself. If you look at the Palestinian issue, on the issue of Hamas, it's shown a bit more favorable attitude towards Hamas that strengthens Hamas's bargaining position with the Israelis. If you move to domestic politics in Egypt from the Israeli point of view, the fear that the edifice that is the Egyptian state could somehow weaken to the point where the writ of the state no longer extends to key parts of the country means that, and particularly the Sinai, it constitutes a security threat for Israel. So it may not be that the state of Egypt turns against Israel. Well before that, there is the possibility that the state of Egypt itself may not be in a position to where other non-state actors threaten Israeli national security interests. So you have the Egyptian side. The second most important, if you will, concern for the Israelis is obviously Syria right now. And we're seeing a lot of activity on that front where the regime collapse or the pending expected regime collapse in Damascus creates a really, really tough situation for Israel in terms of what kind of, will there be another regime to replace President Assad? It's unlikely in the short to medium term. And in that period, what kind of threats will emanate? I mean, there are all sorts of rebel forces who are currently fighting President Assad and his forces. But once that's done, what will they turn to? And then with Al-Qaeda playing in there between the recent merger between the Iraqi and Syrian branches of Al-Qaeda and the rise of Salafi jihadi groups in the Gaza Strip, from the Israeli point of view, this is a serious threat that somehow needs to be dealt with. And then there is Jordan, and Jordan's king is growing weaker because of the Arab Spring. I mean, he's not in as bad of a position as, the Republican autocrats have been. But nonetheless, he's much weaker. Not only does he face the challenge from the Muslim Brotherhood in the country, but also from people who have historically supported him, the East Bankers or the tribes of Jordan. And there's a lot of dissent there as well. And then, of course, there's Lebanon, and Hezbollah is there, and Iran is there. So this is a very, very dangerous strategic environment in which the Israelis have to live, and they have to somehow manage this. The recent apology from the Israeli government to the Turks, essentially fulfilling that demand that's been in place for the past 3 years, suggests that the Israelis feel that they need to minimize the number of actors that they have to deal with in terms of, you know, opponents. So reducing tensions with Turkey is one way of mitigating the risks in the environment, or at least bringing down the temperature in the region and being able to have some options. But at the end of the day, the biggest problem of Israel is that it doesn't have a whole lot of good options, or at least doesn't have the tools of influence to be able to shape the Arab world as it once used to when the autocratic regimes were very much in place.
When you mentioned that there is the issue of Egypt and, again, sort of a support, a greater support by the Brotherhood of the Palestinian issue and of Hamas, at the same time we have Erdogan going to the Gaza Strip, and maybe this puts a little bit more support again for the Palestinian issue, requiring compromise inside the state of Israel. It seems that, yeah, this is perhaps the stickiest situation they could possibly be in, losing influence regionally, perhaps even losing a strong position they've had, quote unquote, domestically. Does this make Israel perhaps a little bit more tense and on edge? I mean, when we look at, and I don't want to imply there's too much to this, but the KC-135 stratotankers and the anti-radar missiles, perhaps that is mere deterrence. But is there the greater potential for a first strike in an environment, an Iranian first strike, for instance, in an environment where the blood pressure is at a very high level to begin with, domestic issues, regional issues? Or are we really looking at Israel maintaining the quote-unquote poise of the boy on the burning deck, keeping their wits about them and continuing to operate diplomatically and very calmly in what is a growingly chaotic region?
I think it is the latter, because the evidence points to the fact that the Israelis trying to maintain readiness for any eventuality without actually being proactive in terms of shaping the region. As I mentioned earlier, they just lack the tools to be able to shape the region moving forward, especially post-Arab Spring. They also have the experience of Lebanon from 1982 to 2000 with the invasion and then the occupation of Lebanon to deal with the PLO, and it created unintended consequences. Hezbollah was born out of that conflict. That conflict allowed Iran, with the help of Syria, to cultivate a group like Hezbollah and then turn it over the decades into what it is right now. One could call it a state within a state. It doesn't fit the classical non-state actor definition. So the Israelis see the risks of that. So, for example, if they were to intervene in Syria sometime down the road, I mean, if that were to be the case, it'd be a limited intervention to deal with a specific tactical threat that was completely unbearable and intolerable, and so it needed to be done. But I don't see a large-scale operation on the part of the Israelis, because the situation is so fluid. And again, the Lebanese example is very apt, where it was in a state of civil war, and the Israeli invasion only made matters worse. And I think that the United States is also looking at it from the same point of view, and hence its own reluctance. And I think it's going to want to encourage that Israel stay out of it as much as possible. But again, the question is, what are the options? Inaction is not an option. Sitting by is not an option. So what we have essentially is a lack of good options from the Israeli point of view. So I think that, I mean, even if there were to be, well, let me actually step back and actually raise the question whether, what is a bigger threat for Israel right now? Iran and the possibility that it could, at some point in the future, carry out a military strike against Israel, or the immediate environment in which states are devolving into non-state actors, and which is, you know, right in the here and now and in geographical proximity. And so I think that, in my opinion, I think that is far greater of a threat to Israel than, a distant Iran could be. Now, Israel is not going to let its guard down. It's going to maintain that level of military preparedness and continue to enhance it. But that's not the worry way at this point. There are far bigger issues, and namely Syria. And Syria being the most important because, at least in Egypt, you still have the military there. The monarchy in Jordan is still standing, and you know it's not about to wither away anytime soon, though the situation is getting dire. But nonetheless, this is the strategic threat environment for Israel.
Well, Cameron, thank you for helping us organize some of the issues in the Middle East as they relate to Syria, Iran, Turkey, Israel. And we look forward to continuing our conversation and when things develop and when we need greater clarification. We appreciate your expertise.
Thank you.
David, what's fascinating to me, we have Cameron on probably once a year, and how much things change in that year. You know, we were talking just a few years ago about Turkey's relationship with Israel and how it was under stress and strain, and that thing, that's evolved since the time we talked to Cameron about that.
And actually improved quite a bit. We still have this issue, as he mentions, of fragmentation and of diverse pockets of power. The old power structures have been in decline and continue to be. The new power structures don't yet have a full-fledged personality, and thus sort of judging what they will be in terms of either foe or friend, that is something still be determined by either our State Department or those living in the Middle East trying to determine whether the winds blow.
Well, and I think it's also interesting for a lot of our listeners watching Israel in particular to see what he said about their options. They really have no good options. Things are starting to crumble around them, and inaction is not necessarily correct action, is what Cameron said.
Well, and as Cameron mentioned, maintaining readiness is the position they have to take, and we will continue to monitor the Middle East as something that is a bit of an X factor in terms of the global economy and stability, whether that's oil prices and really the critical impact that the region can have on the world markets. Later this year, we'll have Cameron back on as he publishes a book, Political Islam in the Age of Democratization. We talked to him today from London, where he's finishing his PhD.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Cameron Bakari. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.